towards the end of the chapter. But yes, the first thing we need to sort of try and get clear are these terms, phantasm and simulacra. So if you turn to page, first of all, let's just quickly get a definition of phantasm. So turn to page 36. And there are some sort of definitional terms through chapter 6 as well. So if you look at page 36, there's a nice succinct So if you look at the paragraph that begins every living being, okay? So every living being interprets, we're all there, we all found that, yes? Every living being interprets according to a code of signs, responding to variations in excited or excitable states. Whence come images, representations of what has taken place or what could have taken place, and thus a phantasm. Okay, so there's a definition there of what a phantasm is. Not particularly helpful perhaps to you immediately, but it's a starting point. It's where you can begin, you know, by looking quite simply at what someone is saying explicitly to at least get a handle on what they're saying, even if you don't necessarily understand it starting.
So is there a notion of a dance between possibility and actuality? In the form of a representation.
Well, what's noticeable about the images there? What's noticeable about the type of images they are?
It looks like it's kind of memories. It's talking about, well, not memories necessarily, but what has taken place, what could take place.
So what's excluded? What's not mentioned?
What can't take place?
The moment.
What is taking place? Okay, it's not a phantasm. Is not about something that is taking place in that sense. Okay, it's either a counterfactual, what could have been, or as you rightly point out, something like a memory, what has taken place. So it's a sort of after effect in a way, or it's a product. It's probably a better way of putting it. And the product could be, you know, either memory or alternative. Something different could have happened. Now there's another wish. Obviously that's this core ontology that we're thinking of, that are essentially generative of phantasms. Okay? So that's the other thing to note, is that phantasms are the product or the after effect, they're generated by the impulses. That's what immediately impulses generate. So this is going to help. So one of the things that's going to be important here is impulses do not generate simulacra. First of all, they first of all generate phantasms. Think of phantasms as ghosts. That's why I'm saying something like an after effect or an after image. So this particular section carries on. The simulacrum is not the product of a phantasm, but its skillful reproduction by which humanity can produce itself through forces that are thereby exorcised and dominated by the impulse. In the hands of the imposter philosopher, the Truger builder, the simulacrum becomes the willed reproduction of non-willed phantasms, born from the life of the impulses. We are now tightening up our definition. Simulacra are willed, phantasms are not willed. In other words, simulacra are, in a sense, what occurs as a result of a phantasm being produced. So the impulses produce phantasms, and then some phantasms then have this extra effect, as it were. Because obviously, one of the things, why would this work like that?
Why some of them? What accounts for that some? There seems to be something special about those that are chosen and those that are not. Or those that actually are pushed through and those that are not. Is it completely arbitrary, the reason for that?
No, there's a very clear, simple, straightforward. One of the phantasms that's produced is the phantasm of the subject. Hmm. The phantasm is of a, you know, thing with a will. So if we remember from last week, that passage about how the impulses appropriate and are appropriated, they sort of form this peculiar combination of like producing a sense of self, which then reappropriates the fact that the impulses as though they were necessary, as though I was necessary. So I'm sort of produced as a chance event, and yet at the same time, the particular phantasm that is the subject, as it were, is specifically a phantasm that perceives itself as necessary. So it sort of folds back. It doesn't want to take account of itself being produced. It wants to sort of see itself as a necessary starting point. So I must have been, almost. And so this particular phantasm of the subject, the sense of self, or of the agent, which is the term he uses, the supo, the agent, that's the particular phantasm that then is entwined with this problem of the will.
So why a particular phantasm as opposed to another particular phantasm in that sense? How do we establish a subject from a phantasm that just comes straight from the impulse? Is it going to be the will to power that of one particular phantasm as opposed to another that will inevitably be a subject in a simulacra in the end?
Well, what do you think is meant by simulacrum here? Does anyone sort of want to... What do people think a simulacrum is? No one looked it up in the definition, no one like just checked it in their dictionary.
It's representational likeness. That's another word, but I've got it.
Okay, well, what's the other word that's cognate with it you should be immediately bringing to mind?
Similar.
I wasn't really thinking similar, although there's something connected to that, but more straightforward though. That's one way in which a simulacrum is modelled, but that's not the way in which he's modelling it, because a copy suggests an original model of which there's a copy. Simulation. Okay, a simulacra is cognate with the notion of a simulation. And so think of something like, you know, The Sims, or think of virtual reality, or, you know, these are simulations. Now, they're not copies. Okay, a simulacra in that sense is not a copy. It can copy something, but that's not necessarily a copy. So it can have a simulation of this room, specifically of this room with all the details of this room, or I could just have a simulation of a room. And in that latter situation, there's no original that I'm making a sort of simulation of. It's just a simulation, you know. Second Life is a simulated world, but there's nowhere that's originally like that. You know, that it's a copy of, because otherwise things would be very disturbing. Well, you know, it's like it's just fucking all the blocks that keep sticking together. You walk through the damn place, it gets on me. Now, originally, the simulacrum derives from something in Roman, well, particularly in sort of Roman, a little bit in Greek as well, but I mean, I think the Romans had a sort of stronger version of this, in which the statues of the gods were the statues of the gods did not represent the gods. And that's one of the crucial differences between pagan statues, pagan images, and Christian images. And one of the reasons, in fact, that Christianity, in many of its forms and other monotheistic religions, has a problem with iconography, a problem with representations. It doesn't like the idea of representations. It has a difficulty dealing with representations. Pagan simulacra, pagan statues, were not representations of God. They were the God. Okay? They are an instance of it. So you're not, you know, going up to the stand. And this, to a certain extent, is the same process that occurs within Hinduism, within the relationship Hinduism has to its own statues. And so the image is not an image of, it is the thing. It's like, in a sense, this thing, one of the words that's often used is avatars. Like gods in the pagan religions have avatars. In other words, these gods appear in certain forms. Now, one of the usual ways in which you would talk about an avatar in those religions is as a sort of specific person or a specific incarnation, in the way in which Christian and monotheistic religions, you know, perceive perhaps Christ as a sort of incarnation of God. But Christ is not an avatar of God or a simulacrum. He's his own specific sort of trinity figure. Whereas in pagan situations, in these more, you know, these different types of religions, what they work with is a notion of, essentially, gods and goddesses as forces, a combination of forces. So the earth, the air, the wind, the water, these are particular forces which are, as it were, personified. So they have names, they have characteristics, they have histories, they have relations and families. So they are, in a sense, personified. We might even want to say there's sort of an anthropomorphization of natural forces. They're a way of dealing with these as natural forces. And we see echoes of this nowadays when we name hurricanes or storms. You know, we still have a sort of echo of treating a set of forces as a personality or as having a characteristic. And so this approach to gods and goddesses in pagan religions is essentially the ground from which simulacrum are then born. So the forces themselves produce certain characteristics, and these are phantasms, we might say. And the simulacrum is then this way in which we will an encounter with it, so we make something to, as it were, give us a way of talking to the god or the force or the goddess. So that thing exists out there, and it's sort of produced by the forces, but the individual human then, as it were, paints it or reproduces something that makes them, you know, connect to it visually, physically, materially in front of them. So a simulacrum is quite often, in that sort of situation, going to be something like a physical representation. Okay, that's one of the things that's going to be quite different. It's going to be something that's made, whereas a phantasm is just something that occurs. Okay, so that relationship between, you know, the god or the goddess or the forces occurring, and then you try to negotiate or discuss with them, the negotiation or discussion or the encounter with them is going to occur precisely through, you know, this, more commonly through this production of a simulacrum, some sort of face, as it were. You know, produce some sort of face. And this is one of the reasons why Kozovsky will talk about on page 102, the fact that art is very, very important in trying to understand this notion of what a phantasm is, because art is, in the sense, this sort of, you know, core approach to negotiating with or dealing with phantasms. Now, outside of the sort of general natural physical forces, which we might want to characterise in these pagan terms as sort of sets of gods and goddesses, you know, that's, in a sense, all those natural forces were, that's all that was going on, we might say, in those religions, is that natural forces are given characteristics and given names and histories. And nowadays we talk about, you know, sort of scientific laws, or we talk about abstract things like the cosmos or a universe or a solar system, you know, planets. You know, we have different names, whereas previously these things would be named as gods and goddesses. In that situation, the natural forces, as it were, are, you know, given a face through a simulacrum. Now, the thing that we're interested in, or Klosowski's interested in, is how does this work in terms of thought? Okay, how does this work in terms of thought? Because if the principle that everything is impulses is applied radically, then there is, strictly speaking, nothing other than forces for the ground of any thought or subject. Okay, there is no sort of starting point, if you remember. We don't start from the subject. We need to look for the production of the subject, where it's, you know, produced from, what generates something that thinks of itself as a subject. In particular, what generates something that thinks itself, something that thinks it has a thought. And this goes right to the core of modern philosophy. Like Descartes' argument begins from this notion that the fact that I am thinking is so clear and distinct that it necessitates the implication that I exist. The condition of my thinking is my existence. The condition of my thinking for Kazovsky is not going to be my existence.
Is it existence or is it consciousness?
It's not even that. It's just forces. The condition for my thinking is merely that there is a combination of impulses that's produced a phantasm. That's the condition of my thinking. The condition of my consciously thinking, my being self-conscious, is that I produce a simulacrum. So thoughts, fundamentally, are simulacra. But they're simulacra of thoughts.
So we've got two types of thoughts here.
This is why we have to use this willed and non-willed thing. We've got two types of thoughts. Thinking is not singular in this way. We have thoughts that just, as it were, happen. You don't think them. The eternal return is one of those thoughts. You don't think them, it thinks you. It occurs. It is a combination of forces that occurs. It doesn't need you to happen. You are, in a sense, irrelevant to it. You are not the ground of it. You are not the production point that starts the eternal return. It is, as it were, a phantasm. Now, the encounter with the will, the eternal return revolves around this issue of can you will it? So can you will it? Can you make this, you know, the subject of your will? Can you affirm it? That's the whole point of that thought experiment. And so the absolute crux of this movement between phantasm and simulacra is at some point the production of something that takes itself to have a will. Okay? Somehow a notion of will occurs. And for Nietzsche, this means that, you know, your will occurs as the result of a set of forces, occurs fundamentally and first and foremost as a sort of phantasm. It's a sort of collection of forces that produces this sense of self. By sense of self here, we can be a bit more specific, a sense of something that has a will, has its own will. Now, you've got a sort of unconscious-conscious split that you might want to use here almost. You know, don't think too strictly in terms of that, but there's something like an unconscious-conscious split. The phantasm is something like an unconscious, the simulacrum is something like the conscious, but he's using different terms precisely because he doesn't want to work with this rigid Freudian split, something we looked at in the first couple of weeks.
So if you will the non-will, would that completely dissolute you? You become, I don't know, that it'd be like a destruction, in a sense, of the subject. But then you'd have to forget it, wouldn't you? No. Well, hypothetically, what would happen if we willed the non-willed? If we willed this phantasm? If we willed this notion of thinking just happens to me. If we willed the eternal return, what would occur?
In a sense, the will itself is that which needs to be willed.
The will itself.
Because the will itself is is first and foremost a phantasm.
But not
so this is this folding back movement. It's not like you have a will. In a sense, you need to fundamentally sort of encounter yourself as capable of having will, but you're not even... I mean, this is where we have a real problem in talking of selves here, notions of self. There isn't, in a sense, some you outside of this process that stands aside and can do or not do this. This isn't really up to you. It's not really something that you can, you know, just choose to do. You can. Nietzsche thinks, or according to Zelotsky, Nietzsche thinks that you can, if you begin to encounter this sort of this ontology in which you are just the result of forces, you are just a chance effect, you are just something unnecessary in that way that perceives itself as necessary, you know, all these other things, then you can, by encountering this, as it were, become free again by realizing that, you know, you're just a bunch of cells. Really just a bunch of cells and, you know, organized matter and various energetic, various electrical impulses and neurochemical structures. That's all you really are. There's nothing else. And you all want to say that there's something else, and you all talk about yourself as though you've got something else, but in fact, what else is there? Why would you even want to not accept that you're just a bunch of, you know, unthinking, instinct and need-driven cells, chemicals, 80% water, blah blah, all that sort of crap that, you know, natural physicists tell us you are. Why would you even want to think something different?
Except the party needs it all stopped.
That's the actually sort of being willing to will that you are this, as it were, pure physicality.
Just the accepting fact.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes, I mean, fact is a strong and loaded word, but accepting this as a sort of, as your model of reality. Because you're not, you can't yet prove that it's true or not, but living as though it were true, I suppose. So, but why would anyone want, why does anyone, you know, want to think anything different? Why do you not just, you know, accept this anyway? Why do you use the word I, subject, self?
You seem to become redundant if you accept that. There seems to be a liquidation. And
of
so,
what,
exactly, of what? That's a good question.
What are you going to lose? The psychologist tells you that he can predict, or she can predict, all of your activities.
Very well. Is what, I mean, if it's...
Are you going to believe this, though?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to believe them?
Tell them.
Well, if they say, I can predict everything, what are you going to do?
Tell them.
You don't want to be, do you? I mean, there is
fundamentally... Right.
It's a fundamentally... I don't suppose it's right. It's kind of depressing. You don't want, actually, a pretty happy choice. And it's
well, let's be concrete about this. Have anyone seen The Century of the Self? It's really worth looking at. It's a very, very good. It's a film by Mark Curtis. He makes extremely good films. Very, very good documentaries. If you've never seen it, then really you should absolutely make it a priority to watch it. It's available on various places online. I'll put a link up on the website, but it's fairly easy to get hold of. It's called The Century of the Self, Mark Curtis. And it basically explains how Freudianism was taken by Freud's brother or his cousin, I think he might have been, and used in propaganda during the Second World War. It was used as the basis for propaganda. And then from that point it was then used as the basis for the advertising industry. Okay, so the advertising industry was based upon Freudian notions, and its success derives from a fundamental concept, which is you will buy what we persuade you to without you even knowing why. Now, you can say, well, that doesn't work, but the truth of the matter is, it does, and you do. You don't know why you buy it because someone else has told you to do so, and in that sense, you are nothing more than an automaton. Why do you not like this thought? Why would that make you feel uncomfortable? Most people I know don't want to accept this, so you're basically a bunch of robots.
You want to be an individual?
Source of control as well.
But why would you want to be an individual? Where does that desire come from?
that's the way we've been educated, brought up, raised. You're an individual, you do this, you do that. It's kind of part of the culture, isn't it?
That, I think, is absolutely crucial, and that's one of the tensions that Nietzsche's looking at here, is that this tension between the idiosyncratic, the noble, the individual, and the gregarious, you know, the social, the collective, the group, the community. And one of the things he's saying towards the end of this chapter, if you look at the end of this chapter, one of the interesting things that's going on at the end of this chapter, is he begins to say that the way in which we pursue getting the overman is not by fighting against the increasing gregariousness, but by actually pursuing it, by making it go further. And he comes right at the end, in this way, by realising, last paragraph on page 130, in this way, by realising one aspect of Nietzsche's project, industrialism, which today has become a technique. Sorry, let's read this again. In this way, by realising one aspect of Nietzsche's project, industrialism, which today has become a technique, forms the exact inverse of his postulate. It is neither the triumph of singular cases, nor the triumph of the mediocre, but quite simply a new and totally amoral form of gregariousness. The sole agent left to define existence, not the superhuman, but the super gregarious and master of the earth. What he's suggesting there is that the culture that we're talking about, which has encouraged the individual, is now actually disappearing as we encourage no longer the individual. What's the new name that you're meant to be? What are you, really, according to the government, the figures, the bosses, the bankers? You're not individuals. They never talk about you as individuals anymore. Consumers. You are consumers, you are cogs in a machine. You are not even told any longer that you are individuals. So in that situation, why does anyone still maintain this desire to be? You're all happy with this, whether you like it or not, whether you explicitly accept it or not. You're all happy with this because you live in a consumer city that relies on you being a consumer. If you didn't like being a consumer, you wouldn't live it. You'd go somewhere else. So we're all, and that includes me, we're all, in a sense, happy to be these cogs in machines. Move along. Why just keep pursuing? Why then maintain any notion that you want to be an individual? What in your current culture suggests that this is a good thing?
Well, I'm backtracking on that now. Excessive individualism.
I think so. I mean, you're not meant to smoke. Take drugs, get too drunk, play loud music, various other things, because obviously the community comes first, the gregarious over the social, and the gregarious rather over the individual. These things are quite, you know, fundamental concepts, fundamental. This thing about your individuality, you want to be an individual, you know, it's coming partly from culture. But what most of us, I think, would take it to be absolutely core to our very existence, whatever that is. Yeah? Would that sort of seem reasonable? Most of us would find it difficult to just think of ourselves fundamentally as numbers. One extra number. So, why hang on to this? What are you going to gain from it? Do you gain pleasure from it? Right, okay. In what sense might you gain pleasure from it?
Just in being different. In being different.
Right.
I suppose in being better than somebody else, like it would. I'm individual and my individuality is kind of better than your individuality.
I'm special, I've got meaning to my life.
I think you're right, we want to be different, but I think that's the word to look for is this connection with meaning. You know, I mean, somehow things mean for me. They don't just mean, you know. And if I don't understand it, it's got no meaning. That's how people quite often relate to modern art, for example. My little kid can do that, it doesn't mean anything. It's, you know, blah, blah. It's not really, you know. What they're really saying is, I don't know what that means, therefore it's got no meaning. Not, I don't know what that means, therefore I don't know what that means, and I should maybe fucking learn and stop being such an ignorant twat. I just think, I don't know what it means, therefore it's emperor's new clothes, therefore it's got no meaning, therefore, you know, if I don't get it, it's just bullshit. I mean, that's really dominant nowadays. If I don't get it, it's really just a lie. Not if I don't get it, I'm stupid. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. If you don't get something, you're stupid in relation to it. There's no two ways about that, and we were all stupid in relation to certain things. I'm completely stupid in relation to trying to actually get a proper organised fund of money coming in on a normal adult basis. You know, it's just completely stupid in relation. No idea how that works. No idea how it's meant to work. Never have done and really done it anymore. So I'm just congenitally stupid at trying to earn money. It just doesn't work. Everyone's stupid in relationship to something. I don't get, for example, you know, I really just don't get, even though I've tried to get manga. I've sat down with it, we've looked at it, read it, my kid loves it, students tell me it's wonderful, I've tried reading a whole variety of stuff, I just don't fucking get it. Hellblazer, Now, this sense of like meaning is, if it's meaning for me, then it seems to depend upon my existence. And if I am, in a sense, the product of a phantasm, and as it were, just a chance event, then this meaning is also just, as it were, a chance event. It's just something, what we're essentially saying is, we're saying something like, it's not real. Meaning in this situation is not real. It's not in the world, by which I mean somehow out there and I discover it. But it's also not just something that I invent. Like I can just invent anything I like, you know, it means anything. Like the Cheshire Cat in Lewis Carroll. I can say whatever it wants to. I think it's Humpty Dumpty actually in Lewis Carroll. I can say whatever I wanted to say and I can mean whatever I want to mean. But that's pure arbitrary meaning. You know, so the alternative is quite often seen as pure arbitrary meaning or, you know, real inverted commas meaning that's out there that I discover. So we often pose this invention discovery option. You know, either meaning is purely invented or it's really discovered. You know, the former, well, this doesn't really exist. The latter, well, it really is true. It exists then. And what this suggests is whatever the phantasm is that produces this sense of self, subjectivity, I, the way in which it produces it is by producing what we would think of as meaning. So it doesn't produce it out there, it doesn't produce it as the result of an I that already exists. The I and meaning, as it were, come together. They are the same thing. So when you've been reading through this section, we're looking at this, for example, on page 101. Let's start with this, as I say, where we look through some of this in a bit more detail. It begins with this move to talk about demystification. Okay, so he's talking about simulacra as mystifications and demystification processes. Talks about on page 101, top paragraph there, what we see at work here is a false, is a positive notion of the false. So the idea of making up fictions, representations, artistic representations, these being somehow positive powers of the false. And so the simulacrum in this sense is connected to a positive power of the false. So then it's this lovely sort of sentence. Mystification, according to Nietzsche, is not simply the way a potentate operates. In other words, it's not simply, you know, an ideology given by Stalin or, you know, Hitler or Gordon Brown or whoever it is, you know, telling you that you absolutely have to save the banks because otherwise your whole life will collapse. I mean, obviously that's just straightforward mystification, it's like a bollocks. You know, how is your life going to collapse? What exactly is going to happen to you if all these banks disappear? Well, if you've got a bank account and you've got an overdraft, one of the things that will happen to you, of course, is you won't have an overdraft anymore. You know, you wouldn't have any money in that bank if you had a positive account, but if you've got a credit card, an overdraft, a mortgage, then obviously the company that owns that suddenly disappears, then so does your debt. So quite how this stuff doesn't, you know, destroys your life, it ought to do obviously with those people who do have lots of money in bank accounts, those companies that do have lots of money in bank accounts. And the idea that everything's going to collapse is obviously just a load of mad shit. What they mean is everything as it is now will collapse. In other words, those who have power now will no longer have it. But they don't say that because that's mystification. So that's the general way in which we might pose mystification, as sort of this power given to us, this model or ideology given to us by someone in power. That's not, for Nietzsche, as he just said, mystification is not simply the way a potentate operates, rather it is the very ground of existence. So it's not like there's a truth, this is what Nietzsche's saying, a real truth out there that you can get to. Everything appears in a certain way, and yet it appears that way as the result of forces. And as we looked at the phantasm, in other words, everything appears as it were as a phantasm, but the phantasm is only a memory of what was or what could have been. It's never what is. Phantasm is not a product of what is. It's not, in that sense, something that enables you to encounter existence as it is right here and now. It's the after effects. And just like, you know, you look at those pictures in Australia and the images could, you know, once the fire's gone through, it could have been a hurricane or it could have been, you know, a firestorm. It's just a storm. We don't know exactly what element it was, but obviously it's very different if you're there where it's a firestorm or it's a hurricane, but it looks pretty much the bloody same. You know, the houses are flattened, everything's destroyed. The after effect looks similar, even though the forces involved are radically different and have radically different, you know, effects in that sense, but they produce, as it were, the same after effect. So we might almost say that the phantasm looks almost indistinguishable. You'd have to look a lot harder at the singeing, perhaps, or a certain sort of thing. You'd have to be right down close, a distance. The phantasm can look the same. So, in that sense, forces can produce phantasms that look the same because they're always after effects, they're never the immediate present, and that's how he's talking about the bins of a mystification. It's the very ground of existence. Demystification, he goes on, had hitherto been the unadmitted task of the savant, the knower. That's all I refer to, you know. The one with knowledge. Demystification had hitherto been the unadmitted task of the savant. But demystifying in order to mystify better, no longer simply to exploit, but to favour these obscure forces as creative and fecund, now becomes the practice no longer of the philosopher, but of the psychologist. So what does this mean? Why would you demystify in order to mystify better, no longer simply to exploit, but to favour these obscure forces as creative and fecund? What is it that helps, or what is it that's done? Well, let's be explicit. When a psychologist offers an explanation for why you, you know, fall in love, and how it's similar to eating chocolate, or you know, why you have a work ethic, why you're disgusted at the smell of shit, or whatever it is that they're offering an explanation of. You know, what is being done there? How would this, straightforwardly, what's being done? If the explanation is interesting, then
a meaning is given.
But what sort of meaning?
Truth.
What sort of meaning? If an explanation is interesting, did you have it before?
No.
Right. So did you have no explanation before?
No, but it's a new explanation.
It's a new one. It's something different. It's pointing to other forces that you hadn't noticed. Forces that were sort of underlying, maybe entwined. And now you think, oh, well, it wasn't really my own attraction to the, you know, particular shape of their face or the curve of their neck. It was really just you know, the time of my life for some sort of biological function. You know, it was the full moon and my menstruation or whatever, you know, some sort of psychological, physical effect really that I was attracted, and I was just a bit unlucky, you know. So that sort of time of the month and I happened to get, you know, married on the wrong day sort of thing. So you've got this new explanation, and of course that makes, you know, either sense, you either like it or you don't like it, depending on other things that are kicking around. But you feel like if an explanation is new and it works, somehow it reveals something to you, some set of causes that you didn't previously know. And this is just another language for sort of pointing to a different set of forces than the one you previously thought were the ground for how you felt, how you existed, how you were. So that's this idea of demystifying. Now, if we take that explanation, as the psychologists nowadays do, to be the truth, then we leave Nietzsche behind and we move to accepting something like a reality principle grounded in science. Now, what Nietzsche wants to sort of say is, well, actually, let's just not assume that reality principle. I mean, all we're doing here is, one, when an explanation is given that's new and that's interesting, all it's doing is, as it were, producing a new mystification. And this can be done quite deliberately and creatively. In other words, we might want to deliberately treat each other as responsible, autonomous agents capable of making decisions. Because by doing so, we might find that we can live in bigger and more powerful communities. And in that sense, you know, the effect will be we live in bigger and more powerful communities, we can carry out war more effectively, we can destroy the neighbour's tribe more effectively because we've got a better social organisation. But that social organisation depends upon training ourselves to think of each other as independent and rational, or maybe for a Spartan, training ourselves to think of ourselves as cogs in the state. So the Spartans, the Athenians, these people have different training regimes. They produce a different organism, a state, a city, by instigating certain training regimes, mystification processes, treating yourself as though you were. Now, let's pursue this a bit further. The next paragraph complicates the matter slightly. After saying that essentially Nietzsche looks like this psychologist, looks like another person who's trying to offer us a new set of explanations, which would really be a sort of re-mystification, you know, then it's a little bit more complicated. This at first sight seems to be the intention of this proposition. Yet the very terms demystification and remystification, if rationally speaking they seem to correspond to this project, serve only to make the project seem completely untenable. How can one demystify anew? Nietzsche must therefore have had something in mind other than the promulgation of deception through the invention of a simulacrum. So this is, and one of the things you should notice, this is the way Kozlowski argues. You should have seen this already in chapter 3 when we were looking at the antinomy between the will and the eternal return. Looked at last week. Notes which I have put on in the web CT now, so you can look at those, but we talked about that last week. See, what Nietzsche does is say, well look, if this is the way it is interpreted, it doesn't make any sense. If this is the way we understand it, it doesn't make any sense. Therefore, it must be understood and interpreted in a different way. Okay, so this is absolutely important when you're reading through Kozlowski, because sometimes he will be giving you this other interpretation that doesn't make sense, he thinks. If you get that wrong in your reading, you're going to end up presenting completely the opposite of what he's trying to suggest. So what he'll go is like, look at this interpretation, this is how it works, it gets to this point, but this doesn't really make sense. You know, so it can't be that, it must be something else. What else is it? This is what's going on here. The simulacrum looks like it's a power of the false, it looks like it's a, you know, new way to demystify by remystifying. But this doesn't seem to make an awful lot of sense. How can you demystify anew? How can you, you know, if it's demystified, then it was mystified and now it's demystified. You know, it's like a straightforward dichotomy. It was false and now I've demystified it, you have the truth. But that doesn't, you know, that seems illogical, it doesn't seem rational to working with those models. Now, of course, Nietzsche might just be incoherent, but he's favouring this idea that there's something else going on. And so that's why he makes this move. Nietzsche must therefore have had something in mind other than the promulgation of deception. And look at that phrase. He must have had something in mind. Grotowski is not saying that Nietzsche knew what he had in mind. Okay? He's not saying that Nietzsche intended to write something else. And somehow I have to extract this real intention from the mess he made of writing it down. Okay? Nietzsche had something in mind. That something is precisely a phantasm. As he writes, he makes a simulacrum. Each time he makes that simulacrum, in a sense, the phantasm isn't destroyed or accurately represented. It's a bit like trying to sketch a landscape. Constantly you can sketch the landscape and you can sketch it every day and it will look slightly different each time. The landscape doesn't suddenly disappear. The landscape has its own dynamic, its own forces, which in the constant encounter with it, the constant attempt to put it down, as it were, in the simulacrum, and that constant encounter and that constant attempt to put it down, we sort of get closer to it. So when we write or when we speak, we don't say what we intend to say. We don't write what we intend to write. What we write is, as it were, a simulacrum of something that we have in mind. There's a sort of thought prior to language. That's absolutely fundamental to this. The phantasm is, in this sense, a thought prior to language that I struggle to express properly, accurately. If I'm sensible, I won't stop trying to do so. I'll write it down, then I'll rewrite it down, then I'll try it again, and I'll try it again, and I'll find that this bit doesn't work, and I don't like that bit, and I'll try it again. But it doesn't mean I necessarily give up the idea that I had a thought in mind. It might be the same thought in mind that works all the way through one single part.
So
the
simulacrum would be like an interpretation of phantasm?
Yes, it is, in that sense, very much so. I mean, a phantasm is also a sort of interpretation, but a simulacrum is definitely closer to what you usually think of as an interpretation. You know, it can be right or can be wrong. So a phantasm is taken to be an interpretation in the sense in which it's meant to be a dominant force over a sort of submissive force. But when you're talking about interpretation, it's like we could have three or four different versions of something. Yeah, that's very much what a simulacrum is. There can be multiple versions, multiple simulacra. What we would think of is something like a single phantasm.
Okay. But like going back to your analogy of the painting, taking a picture of the painting, the picture's the interpretation, the picture is the simulacrum, the phantasm would be the landscape.
Yeah. I mean, that's the analogy. Obviously, in this sense, the phantasm is like... you'd have to imagine that painter, that picture of the landscape, in order to get a sort of sense of movement. Imagine that picture of the landscape being taken every 10,000 years. So, on a sort of geological time scale, you know, you're trying to capture sort of, you know, this particular bit of landscape. Of course, in the course of 100, 200, 300, 400,000 years, which if you put it into a movie, would obviously give you like 10 seconds or something, the thing would be barely coherent, barely stable. So you have to sort of think of it in terms of sort of geological time. The analogy works, but only on that sort of time. So Nietzsche's simulacrum is not simply, this is the point that Grotowski is trying to make, it's not simply, although it seems to be bound up with this approach of creative fictions. There's definitely something of that there, and lots of interpreters of Nietzsche will just simply stop at that point. Nietzsche wanted to make fictions up so that we could train ourselves better, we could choose what type of beings we were going to become, choosing the training that we're going to instigate.
It's funny what you say about inventing fictions. I was talking to somebody the other day, and it's amazing how as a child, like, you're sort of immersed in this world of fantasy, all these stories that aren't really real, that you're sort of, like Father Christmas, the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, like when you were a kid, you kind of believed these things was real. And we were talking about how that made a training for like abstract thinking.
Well, I mean, curiously, he stopped doing it. That's what's more curious.
Yeah. Well, not really. He believed in God, so it's sort of a continuation of this.
Right, okay, but that sort of indicates something. I mean, why is... What's the dominant force that stops you from maintaining your childhood relationship to fantasies?
Everybody else.
Gregarious. So, as you can see, idiosyncrasy and singularity and individuality there is actually far closer in the child and their relationship to the phantasm, the fantasy of Father Christmas or the Tooth Fairy or an imaginary friend. It's actually, you know, they're expressing their individuality there, that's their relationship, you know, their imaginary friend, all of which is drummed out to the point at which if you maintain it when you're my age, you're put into a lunatic asylum. It's not even, you know, funny to do so at my age. Seriously maintain I had an imaginary friend or no, I actually have congress with gods and goddesses, etc. If you were to seriously maintain that and actually,
you know, the latter one, not
behave as though it was there, talk to it, you know, open the chair, give it the drink, and, you know.
Some people like to make a lot of money out of it though, so always
get sick. Well, yeah, I mean, perhaps performers and people like that, perhaps there's a relationship to performance that's of interest there, because performers would possibly work. Now, after he sort of makes his move to say, well, it's not just generative fictions, it's that point that he then rediscusses his relationship to phantasms, simulacra on 102, and sort of moves to 103. Okay? So that's the sort of structure of this opening point. It opens from the start of the section on 100 through to that sort of paragraph in the middle of 101 with a sort of an account that you will find quite common. Nietzsche, that he's making fictions as a positive power, etc. And then he sort of says it can't work, so that's why he moves on to this notion of simulacral phantasms. That's what takes you through the rest of 101 through 102. You move into about 103, and at about 103, first introduction of this idea of reality principle and